The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This is Mike Consul. Welcome to the program. My guest is Ben Young. He's Chief Investment Officer at Buckingham, an Indianapolis-based real estate investment firm focused on building and operating apartments in the Midwest. As CIO, Ben Young oversees the firm's asset management and investment division. Prior to joining Buckingham, he was managing director at BlackRock in New York for 9 years. As head of BlackRock's U.S. real estate private equity business, he was responsible for the growth and management of an $11 billion portfolio of investments ranging from core value add to opportunistic strategies. He is also a visiting lecturer at in the real estate department at the University of Michigan. And Ben Young can tell you that there's a big difference between the Big Apple and the Hoosier state of Indiana or the U.S. Eastern and Western seaboards and the so-called flyover states of the Midwest. And that's our focus. The overlooked opportunities in the vast middle of the country, the ethos of its people, both as workers and apartment residents, and also who's going to win this year's NCAA basketball tournament, which is often held, the Final Four often held in Indianapolis. Not this year. It's going to be in Phoenix this year, but nonetheless, Indianapolis is a is famous for its hosting of collegiate tournaments of all kinds. Ben Young, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for the opportunity speaking with you.
You're a pretty tall, angular guy. Have you played some basketball in your day?
I have played a little bit of basketball by default. You know, I was 6 feet when I was 13 years old. A little interesting statistic there, but started with basketball, but wound up becoming a junior Olympic fencer, which worked out quite well for my collegiate career.
Wow. Now, that's an Olympic sport now. Were you ever pursuing an Olympic medal? I mean, not necessarily on the Olympic team, but pursuing the Olympic team?
I was good. I wasn't great. I'd like to admit that. My brother was way better than I, and that's how I got into sport. It was just an incredible sport that taught me a lot about life.
Hey, guys always look dashing in a fencing outfit and a mask and a sword. I mean, that's Zorro territory right there. Who are you picking for the NCAA tournament? Before we get on to apartments, let's get the important stuff out of the way. Do you have a favorite in this year's NCAA tournament?
You know, when you started that commentary, Mike, I was worried you were going to ask me that question.
Are you not a basketball fan?
I am. And my daughter loves to do the brackets, and it's her favorite thing during the year. I am obviously biased to Indiana, and there's a bunch of schools. Obviously, you have Purdue, you have Indiana, and there's an even internal state rivalry between the two. So I'm going to support one Indiana school. Obviously, UConn and a bunch of other schools are really good. So I'm going to deflect and support the state of Indiana.
There you go. There you go. You got to support the hometown. I'll also say I think it's going to be UConn or University of Arizona. Both seem to be complete basketball teams. Although Purdue with their big man there is they're a force. They're a force. No question.
Pretty incredible, isn't it? No doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. So Ben, give us kind of a Midwest perspective. You've lived coastally. Now you're happily landlocked in Indianapolis. What are the basic differences between coastal America and Midwest America in terms of ethos and lifestyle?
Well, look, I'm going to take upon a word that you said, Mike, and hit upon it from an investment perspective, but also talk about ethos. You mentioned flyover states. And look, I come from the East Coast, and historically, the Midwest was called a flyover market. I would argue today, investors nationally and internationally see the Midwest as a fly to state. And why do I say that? And it's a really interesting analysis as we looked at it and we start talking to investors, Mike. You look at returns, right? And returns, if you look historically at returns, and I'm talking about multifamily now for a second, over a long period of time, coastal multifamily have returned generally the same returns as Midwest returns. That's the similarity. The big difference is where the returns are driven from, right? And what do I mean by that? Look, coastal assets have driven their returns primarily 75 to 80% of overall returns come from the residual or cap rate compression in coastal markets. And we saw that over a long period of time. Now, are we going to continue to see cap rate compression? I would probably argue not, but you have to keep in mind where those returns are coming from coastal markets. Midwest markets, Mike, are just the opposite. Again, back to your ethos, slow and steady wins the race. 50% of overall returns from multifamily come from current return, and 50% are from residual returns. So a big difference in investors and institutional investors are saying, well, wait a second, I want diversification and balance in current return. And that's what's interesting. And look, anecdotally, I will also answer your question as well. I've come from the East Coast, New York in particular. I'm now spending 3 to 4 days a week in Indianapolis, and I have an apartment here. And actually, I have a driver's license here. So I've really rooted myself here. And there are different cultures. There's a, when I use the word nice, it sounds very simple, but there's a lot behind it. People work hard, they show up 5 days a week, they're worried about their workers, they're worried about putting in the time, and it's really a nice place to work. And that sounds so trite, but there's so much behind it. And I think that coupled with just the macroeconomics of what are happening in the economy. And what do I mean by that, Mike? Is that if you think about the onshoring of what's going on in the market, right? Think about what Intel's doing. They basically say, I'm building a $5 billion manufacturing plant in Ohio. You think about Lilly, which is Eli Lilly, which is based in Indianapolis, right? They have their main drug is Wegovy, which is similar to Ozempic, but they also have Prozac and other drugs. They're building another manufacturing plant just north of Indianapolis. All of that onshoring and all of that job creation, right? If you look at what those job creations, onshoring job creations did, in 2021, there were 261,000 new jobs just because of that onshoring. In 2022, it was 350,000 coming from automotive, electronics, machinery, and even textiles. So that's a really powerful trend. And if you even step back further and look at geopolitical, what's happening in China and all of these other countries, there's more reason to do this onshoring for companies. And there's a really good trend from that onshoring. And then ultimately, what does that lead to? Obviously, job creation. With job creation is need for apartments.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, you know, the whole people are nice and they show up for work. That's music to the ears of so many people who are on the coast where they're having a really difficult time hiring good talent, also having a difficult time keep retaining that talent, filling positions, not so much necessarily at a high level, but just the day-to-day running of everything from an apartment complex to the local Burger King. There's constantly help wanted signs in the windows there. My brother's in the restaurant business and he can tell you it's never been harder to get people to show up, and you can't get their nose out of joint because he tells me they can walk out the door that day and have another job at another restaurant before the night's over. So it's the other thing I wanted to address, you mentioned slow and steady, and I used to work for a business journal that was owned by a real estate developer in the Midwest. He owned four different business journals. And I remember he came to visit the newsroom one day and we asked, how are things going in Kansas City? And he says, you know, Kansas City, the Midwest, he says, we don't have the big run-ups that you guys have, but we also don't have the crashes. It's much more stable. It's slow and steady, as you said, Ben. And today investors are So often what they really are trying to emphasize is stabilizing that portfolio, getting rid of these wild vacillations that you see with all kinds of different investments and just trying to keep the portfolio stable. You know, for a while there, core real estate just got so expensive that people started talking about secondary markets. Secondary markets were getting a lot of attention, including in the Midwest, and I believe a higher level of investment. Now things have changed a little bit since then. I'm thinking pre-COVID, when people were, everybody wanted core properties. Everybody wanted to be on the coast. They wanted to be in the, you know, premier markets. A lot of this capital flowing from overseas. What about the current state of that in the United States? Are the secondary markets still getting their due? Are Midwestern cities like St. Louis, Kansas City, Indianapolis, Columbus, seeing a higher level of capital flows?
So I'm going to answer that in three ways, Mike, and you brought up a lot. So let me chime in on a few things. First, I'm going to correct you on one thing. A lot of people call these secondary markets, I'm going to call them Midwest markets. And as a matter of fact, I would like to argue that they're primary markets, because what we're seeing is the supply-demand characteristics, back to your comment, in the Midwest are so much stronger than, just for argument's sake, the Southwest or the Southeast, when in those markets, there was just a massive run-up of supply of multifamily units, that they're seeing a mismatch of where price expectations are and where prices are. Coming back to the Midwest for a second, we did not see that run, that massive run-up in supply. So again, that goes back to the slow and steady. Couple that comment with the demand that I just spoke about, right, from all of the onshoring and new jobs that are coming to the Midwest, right, because the cost of labor, the cost of living is much more efficient in the Midwest. You've got a perfect situation where supply-demand characteristics are working really well in the Midwest, where today we're still seeing positive rent growth, 3-5%, versus where you're seeing negative growth. And I'm not picking on Texas for a second, but it just was a function of a lot of supply coming on that market, even though there might be still more demand there. In the short term, you're seeing depressed rental growth, or negative rental growth, as a matter of fact. I laugh for a second because 3-4 years ago, we had a junior analyst and we were stressing our projections. And I said to the analyst, so what's your downside projection? And the analyst said, the analyst said 1% rent growth. I said, what about -5 or -10% rent growth? And the analyst looked at me and said, that's not possible. And I said, just wait and see. And that's happening in the market. And again, there's a lot of dynamics, but you can simplify it to supply demand. There are other attributes that are clearly affecting things in the multifamily market and in other geographic areas, like insurance costs. And insurance costs in Florida, for all the obvious reasons, are much higher than they are in the Midwest. But still, those costs are going up 1.5-2 times versus the 3-4 times in Florida. But those are affecting things. The last thing I would say that I really want to sort of jar people's thoughts here and covering your commentary is the cycle. What's happening in this cycle? And my predictions of what's happening in the cycle. And before I give predictions, I'm always reminded by my finance professor, who said, Ben, remember, projections replace chaos with error. So I'm trying to synthesize.
Slice this one carefully.
Exactly. I'm going to try to synthesize what's going on in the market. Clearly, I'll probably be a bit wrong, but I want to summarize this because it's a really good, more academic perspective to give what's going on. And one of the things I've always followed, and it's been interesting over my career, and to date myself, I have been in this business for north of 30 years, but there's a PhD professor. His name's Fred Volvary. Okay. Pretty esoteric. I like reading that stuff. But he came out with an article in 2012. So I'm putting this in perspective. It's 12 years ago. He talked about the depression of 2026. So that's a powerful comment, making a projection 14 years later. But what he said, and he's been studying cycles since the 1800s, is that basically, real estate recessions occur every 18 years. Now, think about it. Think about 2008. Think about right? 1990. And think about before. He wrote a very deep and dense paper in 1997. And he basically argued, without getting into all the details, that cycles occur every 18 years. And he's talking about 1990, 2008, and 2026. And the premise of his argument was there's one fundamental cause of the boom and bust cycles, and it's massive subsidies to land. And what does that really mean, Mike? In other words, it's cheap credit. So we all can think about the cheap credit that just occurred 2 years ago, right? The 10-year treasury rate was 1.5%. So people were buying multifamily assets at 3 and 4 caps. But even back in 2007 and six, while interest rates were higher, right? But there was cheap credit. Anybody and their brother or a taxi cab driver could buy a house. The credit was so cheap. So it could take its different forms in availability or interest rate. But going back to the 1800s, every 18 years, there creates a cycle. Now, we're starting to see a little bit of the front end of that. Clearly, office is having a massive problem. Multifamily is having a little problem. And I can answer that question in a minute. It's much different than office. But I find it really interesting for both the young people listening to this and the old people. And I think more of the old people will be nodding than the young people. But every 18 years, a cycle happens. And it just goes through that process. And one last thing I'll say before you can maybe ask me a question of where I see multifamily, but Fred had said back in 2012, which is really interesting, by 2014, population growth and demolitions will have reduced the vacancies from the construction bubble. And then the growing economy will pull up rents and land values, attracting the speculation that will generate a 10-year real estate bubble that will peak around 2024. So that just amazes me that he wrote that in 2012.
Now, there are people who are saying real estate crisis now. Well, there's really not a real estate crisis going on, but there are people who say real estate is going through a rough time right now. I mean, it's not a bust, but where do you see the market now? And based on this professor's projection for 2026, what's that going to mean for specifically, let's say, the Midwest apartment market?
Yeah, but look, what I would say is a couple of things before I get into the Midwest market. What does it mean from prices overall, Mike? Look, prices have started to correct and already corrected. When people bought multifamily assets at roughly a 4 cap, and now they're at a 5 cap, and I'm being general, right, of where things are, but that's a rough range. But simple math, Mike, is a 1% change from 4% to 5% is a 25% change in value. So that's what's happening. The public markets are recognizing that, right? Now, and that is where those things are changing. I can get into a little bit more. Well, we can discuss a little bit more. Multifamily, the assets are still good. They're quality assets. It's just a function of what people are willing to pay for them, which is the 5 cap versus the 4 cap, again, in general. So that price has just changed, but the fundamental structure of that asset is really good. On the office side, there's a fundamental structure with the asset. So that's the big difference. Now, shifting to the Midwest, back to your point, the beauty of the Midwest was, yes, it had a little bit of a run-up in prices, but it didn't have the run-up of the coastal markets, because people on the coastal markets predicted several things. One, a hockey stick type growth in rent. That was never projected in the Midwest. So if you're projecting a hockey stick rental growth, you're willing to pay a lower cap rate because that cap rate will rise over time with rising rental rates. So that wasn't there in the Midwest. So cap rates were relatively reasonable. So the movement of cap rates from 2 years ago to today with the obvious change in interest rates are a lot smaller. So you have that, you didn't have that run up, you didn't have that massive build of supply because people thought rents were going to rise so quickly, and you have that consistent demand. So from my perspective, it's a pretty good trifecta of, again, going back to that slow and steady wins the race of why it's not just domestic, it's also international investors that are interested in the Midwest.
You know, multifamily is also getting some relatively new competition in the form of single family rentals and build to rent communities. Is that also happening in the Midwest? I know it's happening in a lot of states around the country on the left and right coasts. Is it happening in the Midwest? And how big an issue is that for apartment investors? How much competition is it really posing?
It's an important component, Mike, and it's a great question. And let me take a step back and talk a little bit about built to rent. And yes, it is happening in the Midwest. If you remember in 2008, everyone, as I said, and their mother and their brother and their dog could buy a house because credit was so available. So there was a massive oversupply of single family homes. And going back to what the PhD professor said was that burned off over time and building was dramatically slower. At the same time, people ignored multifamily back during the global financial crisis or before that, and then realized we needed a bigger supply of multifamily. Today, it's a little bit inverse, right? They ignored building the single family homes and a lot of people went to multifamily. So what happens is a couple of things. There are single family homes that are undersupplied, one. Two, it's very expensive to buy a home and have that down payment. Three, people want flexibility to move in and out of a home. And ultimately, four, people want more space because the natural progression of families are, okay, they start building their family, whether a couple has a child or they want more space or building their family. There's a natural progression to moving out of multifamily and into more space. So the build to rent, and what I mean by build to rent is building single family homes in a community, but people are renting those homes versus buying them, is really an important component and a complement to the multifamily. As a matter of fact, in the Midwest, to answer your question, Mike, directly, we're looking at a number of sites where we build both multifamily and build to rent as a complement because there's demand for both of those type of qualities. So what's happening today is, in general, home ownership is declining. For, you know, historically, it used to be 70%. It's getting close to 60%. But there's still a huge cohort of people that really want to live in homes. And this build-to-rent concept is a really valuable perspective, in my mind, to provide that home in pretty much comparable rents to where they would be in multifamily, but giving that more space, the yard for the dog to run, the yard for the children to run around. And I see this as a permanent complement type of structure versus a competitive structure to multifamily.
Gotcha. So you're giving them a place to graduate to as the family is established or grows. Interesting. So talk a little bit about perception versus reality in Midwestern markets, because I do think a lot of Americans, coastal Americans, have some preconceptions about what the Midwest is about and what the people are like and so on. Are there a few points you would make just in terms of, you know, kind of the perception about the Midwest is this, that, and the other, and reality, here's the truth about the Midwest, the geography and its people?
That's a powerful question, Mike. And I'm going to comment on that since I grew up in the Northeast and I grew up in New York.
When you moved to the Midwest, you were probably surprised by a few things.
I was incredibly positively surprised, Mike, and that's where I'm going. You know, growing up in the Northeast, let me start with New York for a second and state the obvious. Fast-paced, sharp elbows, nose to the ground, don't look up, don't smell the roses, just get things done and move on. And is that totally true? No, right? There's a dynamic, diverse group of people in New York. But that's generally a characteristic. the general characteristic of the Midwest is, yeah, that slow, steady moving organization that just takes things easy. Is that true a little bit? Sure, but what I have seen personally over the last year and living here is a powerful combination. Really smart people, and I'm going to go back to the really nice people. People always talk about it. I have a friend who just moved to Florida in a community, and he's meeting a combination of people from the Midwest, whether it's Chicago, it's Indiana, Ohio, or New York. And he goes, his comment was, boy, it's just refreshing. People are the same intelligence quality, smart and hard driving, but just they present it in a nicer, different way. And that's the difference. And I've really embraced the Midwest as part of my home now, because in the end of the day, I would use the word refreshing. You've got such this strong middle class, upper class, working to improve quality of life and family, but doing it in an incredibly caring and community way. And I think that's the big difference than walking around the streets of New York City with people with their heads down, looking at their phones and thinking about the next trade. And again, as I think about this and I talk to you, it's more of a trade in what's going on in New York versus an investment, which is a longer term view in the Midwest, if that makes sense.
What are the three or five hottest markets in the Midwest? Let me narrow that down a little bit. For the apartment market or the housing market, what are three or five of the hottest markets?
So I'm biased for a second. So I'm obviously going to state Indiana or Indianapolis, just a powerful city. There's a million people in the greater area, tremendous strength. And you have companies like Eli Lilly, Anthem Health, Blue Cross Blue Shield, or Anthem Health Insurance. There's big companies based here that are demand drivers, but you can't ignore Columbus, Ohio, where Intel is building a $5 billion plant. Those are important cities to recognize that I go back to. Great investment cities, slow and steady. I can't ignore the big name, which I'm about to name, is Nashville, because Nashville is... I pause for a second because I laugh. We used to call the next up-and-coming cities nerds. And why do I say nerds? It was Nashville. It was East Bay or Oakland, California. It was Raleigh. It was Denver. And it was Salt Lake City, right? Not all of those are in the Midwest. But I'm trying to answer a question of generally where are those areas up-and-coming. But why? Look, COVID helped. A lot of people were saying, wait a second. I want a cheaper cost of living. I want a better way of life, but I also want cities and good demand drivers. So I touch on Indianapolis. I touch on Ohio. Nashville has been a huge influx, whether it's its music, everyone knows where they want to live. The tax structure is really good there. That those cities saw a lot of supply come on, and there were a lot of cranes, but that city is here to stay. And we're a big believer in Nashville, and we like that. But so people have seen Nashville. I would say the follow through is Indianapolis and Ohio, where people are recognizing, wow, that's amazing. And you look at Carmel, don't say Carmel. You have to know if you're in Indianapolis, you got to say Carmel. But what a beautiful, affluent suburb just north of Indianapolis, where there's high-end multifamily, high-end residential. And when I just drove up there, I was like, wow, this is an amazing place to live. So there are really, truly amazing places to, in that sort of focus of Midwest. There's Louisville, Kentucky, right? That's right. It's amazing. These areas from Indianapolis are drive-to cities, which people don't realize until you get to the Midwest. But again, I'm going to go back to my other comment, because I do talk to a lot of not only domestic but international investors. They are saying this is a fly to market, and it's that Midwest market, not the secondary market. So look, going back to your question, I think there are a handful of cities really there that are showing those demands. But look, Denver has become really big and Raleigh has become really big. Those are not Midwest markets, but they're really up and coming, booming markets that are complementing. And we're seeing similar type of investors wanting those markets as well as the Midwest markets.
So this remote workforce that's emerged, a virtual workforce, remote workforce among, you know, knowledge workers, white collar workers, has benefited the Midwest is what it sounds like, Ben. I was saying this to somebody the other day that, you know, I can take my Google salary from Silicon Valley and move to the Midwest and have a lot more purchasing power and feel that it's not such a rat race. So would you agree that the Midwest has seen an influx of people from the coasts that were looking for a more moderate lifestyle, both in terms of price and pace?
Look, the simple answer, Mike, is absolutely, right? Anecdotally, I'll give you a couple of stories. One, my brother runs a technology company, and 6 years ago, yes, 6 years ago, he gave up his office space and said, I want everyone remote. I think we can be just as efficient and I can allow people to live in their certain areas. It was a brilliant move on his part. And when COVID hit, everyone said, okay, this is a smart guy, even though he sort of knew what was going on. But also, I'm speaking to friends whose families were from the Midwest and saying, well, wait a second, I can be closer to my family and actually work remotely and be productive. Now, so the simple answer is yes. Remote working, technology, COVID, all accelerated that and allowed people to say, I can be based in the middle part of the country that's more economical and maybe a culture that works for them. So it's permanent for my case. How permanent as a percentage of work? That's a good question, because what I'd like to say is, look, I have a daughter just entering the workforce. She lives in New York. She's working for a big financial services company, and they basically said, you have to be in 5 days a week, right? And she came to me and said, Dad, you know, I'm okay with 4 days, not 5 days. For a 22-year-old or a 23-year-old, I actually think more days in the office is better, because that human interaction is really important. Now, take an old folk like myself, there's still an important human interaction where I'm in Indianapolis and working with people, but the flexibility to me to come back to New York or work from other parts of the state is critical, and it allows our employee base to expand and get really good people from across the country to work remotely. So I do think part of that is here to stay. Some companies will say 5 days a week, no matter what. And I get that. And that could be a big financial services company and they could make their decision. I think entrepreneurial companies, mid-sized companies, small-sized companies, or even sort of sub-large-sized scale companies, giving that flexibility is only going to improve your productivity with the workforce to leverage off of some of the best employment staff that's available. That all being said, devil's in the details. We're all in a people business. Multifamily is very much in a people business, and where I work is in a people business. So coming together and spending that time in person is incredibly valuable, right? Developing a relationship in person is way different than over an iPad, a phone, or a computer.
Mm. So one more question, Ben, I want to get back to onshoring. It's a lot of this has been coming to the Midwest. Intel, that's a little different story over in Columbus. The federal government is the CHIPS Act, billions of dollars have been promised and so on. But that's just one case. There's a lot of onshoring that's gone to the Midwest. Why the Midwest? Is this a case where the state governments have offered the proper incentives? What are the factors that have brought a lot of this onshoring to the Midwest versus the coasts?
I mean, that's a great question. And what I would say, it's a myriad of factors, Mike. It is incentives, but look, a lot of states can provide incentives. It's labor costs. But the fact of the matter is labor costs are cheaper simply in the Midwest than they are on the coastal cities. And that's a fact. It's It's logistics and shipping costs. Producing something in the middle of the country and be able to distribute it across the United States is just functionally better in the Midwest than it is in the coastal states. I mean, the argument I have is you look at FEMA, okay? When FEMA came in during COVID and had to do a huge analysis and training for all government employees, where did they pick their headquarters to just focus in FEMA? It was the Midwest. Well, actually, a big part of it was in Texas, but it was in the center of the country because they realized they can get all the people that can come into the Midwest or Texas easily from both coastal countries and then distribute those people. So what companies are realizing, like Intel, like Lilly, are saying, wait a second, logistics, shipping costs, labor costs, quality control, demand drivers, and ultimately incentives make it a perfect storm in a very good way to come to the Midwest. And that's what's driving it. Because if you think about it, if you had your own company, or if you ran Intel, are you going to set up in New York and Boston of just the cost of operations? No. I mean, a big part of why they went offshore was the cost of labor and producing it. Right, they're realizing now because of geopolitical, they have to find a good complement to the cost of labor, which, by the way, is rising overseas. But then they're also really thinking about logistics and shipping. Right, you got problems in the Suez Canal, you got problems around the world. If you can produce something in the Midwest and just have trucks or trains basically do a hub and spoke, that's the primary decision maker. So as these large companies, whether they're automotive, electronics, machinery, or textiles, are starting with the Midwest and saying, where do I choose within that area?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My guest has been Ben Young. He's chief investment officer at Buckingham. They're in the apartment business in the Midwest and the build-to-rent communities most recently. He's also a former managing director at BlackRock in New York City. From New York City to Indianapolis, Ben, I really appreciate you taking the time and drawing these distinctions between the Midwest and the rest of the country.
It's been a pleasure, Mike, and I really appreciate the time. Thank you for the opportunity.